Our previous episodes have gone to great lengths to demonstrate the depth, scale, and intensity of political debates within the Second International. Debates which provided and demonstrated the richness and complexity of its internal life. Throughout the period under review, while these debates both provoked and sustained the International's organizational evolution, it retained the faith of its constituents by staying true to its name and conception, a living embodiment of a fundamental Marxist precept, that of internationalism. In 1914, this notion, that the bonds of class solidarity across state boundaries deprive the working class of any supporting interest in its national bourgeoisie, would collapse under the tension of a profound crisis. This crisis was neither entirely unanticipated nor inexplicable. Quite the contrary, its nigh inevitable appearance had been demonstrated and criticized by socialist parties for some time. This was the degeneration of the capitalist world economy into outright imperialist warfare. The response of international socialism to the outbreak of the World War was one that challenged not only its viability, but the fundamentals of its existence. With few exceptions, most notably Russia, Serbia, and Italy, the major parties of the international lapsed into support for their nation's war effort. Not only did this oblige them to the ignoble task of taking up arms against their comrades, but it saw them descending into the humiliation of declaring the class war temporarily postponed. The representative parties refused the mantle of opposition and settled into supportive arrangements with the ruling class, with minimal resistance and only the most pathetic of overtures. While the eventual culmination of the war would present socialists with the actuality of revolution and result in a new North Star for international Marxism, its immediate effects were to irrevocably destroy the fabric of the international socialist movement, and in doing so, inaugurate a period of painful soul-searching. In this episode, we will trace the responses of socialists to the World War, as well as responses to the existential crises it provoked. This is The Measures Taken.
Let's back up a little bit and let's get into let's go pre 1914. The question of war, as mentioned in the introduction, is not one that socialists are unfamiliar with. In fact, not only proselytizing, but demonstrating the potential inevitability of a great catastrophic war was something that socialists were intimately familiar with, part of their propaganda. So before we get to the betrayal or the capitulation, what were the pre-war positions? What do we have to say about the war under capitalism?
Maybe the first thing to say is that there was a Marxist theory of the maybe not the inevitability, but certainly the heightened likelihood of war under advanced capitalist conditions. Just the fact that they were prognosticating warfare in the way that they did, and I think we'll get into some details later, is remarkable given how long it had been since a continent-wide conflict had broken out. I mean, it wasn't until it was 1815 that the Napoleonic hostilities are finally wrapped up, and it's not until the beginning of the 20th century that you get a genuinely continental conflict. So just prognosticating war in the very first place does set Marxists apart.
I do also think the likelihood of imminent war was increasingly visible to non-Marxists as well. So I don't think that was actually their most unique contribution to their assessment or their approach to the likelihood of an enormous war between great powers. I think what was really unique about the Marxists was that they drew really important distinctions between this type of war and the other types of wars that had preceded it. For example, in the past, Marxists had thought that certain wars where it was the bourgeoisie versus some dying remnants of feudalism or monarchy, and that that it could bring into being a more progressive mode of production, bring into being democracy, things like this, then there was a side to critically support in a war. But that era was over, that this was about capitalist nations competing for carving up the existing world. And so that orientation led the Marxists uniquely to a position where there could be no victor in the war that would be a triumph for the vast swaths of humanity. That instead, in the case of a war, the only thing to do is turn the existing conflagration into a class struggle, into an international class struggle. That instead of siding with one side of the war or another as such, that instead the war must only be an opportunity for the class to take the mantle.
Yeah, the social democratic war on war itself. That's actually a really good point. And I hadn't put it that way to myself before. But just to put some meat on those bones, you know, Marx and Engels think that victory against Tsarist Russia is historically progressive. They even have twisted themselves into thinking that, you know, British colonialism in, you know, in underdeveloped parts of the world might be historically progressive, even if it comes, you know, with benighted consequences. That's just not true of late 19th century social democratic theorizing about war. There's no, yeah, as you say, there's no historically progressive victor.
Yeah, and no, I like that. And I'll, you know, apropos of the point you just said, where it's like perhaps it's to their credit that they predicted war at all, given that it had been a moment. Also, to their credit that they predicted a world war. You know, and this is, it goes to what Matt was saying. I mean, what we're seeing, the arguments for the inevitability of the war and the nature that it. In the nature in which it would unfold is, you know, wrapped up in obviously these discussions of imperialism that we have talked about in previous episodes, that what we're basically seeing is, you know, we know that what we learned from Capital, that Capital has to enter expanded reproduction and constantly grow and grow and grow and expand. And that in fact, it's a limitless need, necessity for expansion. And it turns out that in the real world, the concrete application of that expanded reproduction for theorists of this time will increasingly take on the nature of competing over genuine finite amounts of territory, market control, etc. And, you know, against the notion that the expanded domain of the capitalist mode of production will increase the nice, peaceful, trading, cooperative, natures of what we see is the opposite, that the increased domain of the capitalist mode of production increases the necessity and likelihood of armed confrontation over essentially the battle for finite resources.
Yeah. So you pointed out that the theory of imperialism, broadly construed, and listeners can go back to our episode on imperialism to find out more about what we think about that concept. But broadly construed, the necessity of what had become, by the beginning of the 20th century, advanced export economies with heavy industrial sectors, the need for the accumulation of capital had recruited their own states and financial sectors into the competitive war of all against all, and had not made trade pacific, as you said. Although, we should note that social democrats disagreed about this to a certain extent. Famously, Karl Kautsky thought that if the bourgeoisie could just get its act together, it could enter a phase of super imperialism and, you know, European unionify its way out of maybe the inevitability of conflict.
Right. I mean, this is the notion also that actually the cause of the war is the unique feudal remnants of the German, ruling class, which is incapable of giving way to modernity in any other way, but this death wish of a war, you know, etc.
Okay, so I just want to just put a little bit of a wrench in that, because there's, you know, I've been reading Militarism and Anti-Militarism preparation for this episode. And for those listening who don't know what that book is, it's a pre-war pamphlet, really one of these in the great tradition of social democratic pamphlets, medium-sized books, about the concept of militarism. And this is yet another one of those theories that gets piled on, really grafted onto the theory of Marxism in order to explain the peculiarities of immediate events. But one of the things that stands out to me about that book is that it's not about the accumulation of capital in the first instance. In fact, what he's interested in is how the state has created non-capitalist sectors, namely a kind of, well, military-industrial complex through direct financing and direct organization that competes with, to a certain extent, competes with the private sector, even if it's inevitable given the nature of that private sector's development. So it's both things. It's both the theory of imperialism, which of course comes out of capital, but also about something that's not necessarily strictly a part of the capitalist mode of production.
But yeah, that's right. But Liebknecht also does tether militarism as such, not just to the capitalist mode of production, like you said, but he does say that it is part and parcel of class society in some form, that its development and that its continuation is certainly tied to the domination of one class by another, so that class society is still it's still a function of class society in some way, even if it's not unique to this. It takes on certain features in different versions of class society, but it is a part of that.
Yeah, no, I the point's well taken. In fact, it just makes me want to question the concept and viability of the Marxist conception of class even harder than I otherwise would, right? But we've come against that wall over and over again. There were social democrats, we should mention, that were not necessarily wary, let's say, of the development of national standing armies. The experience of the French in particular stands out. Part of that has to be the legacy of the Great Revolution, in which the levée nationale is so important for France's military success, for the preservation of the French Revolution for as long as it's preserved.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, one of the things I wanted to say about that, it's a good way to dovetail into this point I wanted to make, just as like a brief point of emphasis on something like a demand that you is sort of considered at the time a standard issue, no-brainer demand leveraged by every major socialist party, which is worth mentioning because it seems so far-fetched today. It probably would be the most insane to leverage today. Although that's sadly to our great discredit. But which is the dissolution of the standing army and its complete replacement by essentially citizens militias. Right. And I think, like, you know, like you're saying, that has a sort of revolutionary edge. The history of conscription has a little revolutionary edge. That's a legacy of the French Revolution, the levée en masse, you know? It's like, and in fact, you even see in Germany initially hesitancy to rely on general conscription because of the fear that, okay, maybe we'll provide a mass effective fighting force, but we're also creating the harbinger of revolution in the exact same moment. And when they demobilize, they will march back on the capital and there's nothing we can do to stop them. Essentially, there's a deep reticence on the part of the ruling class to rely on that. And, you know, that point has to be made because it just turns out also when we get to the actual existing revolutions.
There's a grain of truth, right?
The actually existing revolutions, they're impossible to imagine and articulate without rank and file soldiery, right? And so it turns out that that distinction between the standing army and l'armée nouveau, or however you say it.
L'armée nouveau.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was reaching for. The distinction there that is part of that political demand turns out to really historically bear fruit because the class imposition between rank and file and the officer class is fought out in all of these revolutionary sequences in a way that really shows that, yes, the standing army is a permanent threat to the revolution. The workers, armed workers detachments, are absolutely necessary counterweight to it, an alternative to it.
On the other hand, without those disaffected soldiers, without those soldiers who had resisted excessive punishments within the ranks, and without the organization and military training, it's hard to imagine the beginning of the German Revolution. It's hard to imagine the Russian Revolution when all of those soldiers' councils played such a pivotal role. So it really cuts both ways. On the one hand, a standing army is madness, on the part of a social democratic revolutionary to hope for, because, that's the state's fighting force in its struggle to defend itself against a revolutionary overthrow. And on the other hand, a revolutionary overthrow is only in the offing to the extent that there's a segment of the population that's capable of carrying it out.
And I think maybe this is just obvious also, but one of the other distinctions between the standing army and something like a universal citizens militia is that if we do give some credit to the idea of the necessity for defensism in certain circumstances, which is, again, something we inherited from the French Revolution, of course, then that you do want that army to be one that is in some way imbued with class consciousness, whereas the standing army, part of its function, it's not just that it's also an aggressor as well as a defender, ostensibly, of the nation. That's its own issue. But it's also used to put down strikes within the country. So, I mean, it might be a little obvious, but that's also an enormous thing to contend with. And the fact that there weren't those kind of universal citizen militias when war broke out meant that social democracy had no real opportunity to counter mobilize. It didn't mean they had to capitulate in the way they did, but that was still a big issue.
And I may be getting ahead of the timeline of the episodes of the podcast, but I think it's worth mentioning because it's directly related to that. You know, you see in a lot of these key moments in these revolutionary sequences, key turning points, pivots, really decisive moments are often, and especially in the German case, very often fights and struggles over who is being disarmed or who holds, you know, direct military, basically the right to use arms or issues of public safety. You see things where, you know, I don't need to get in the weeds right, but, you know, things where it's like, oh, we've dismissed this particular police chief because of the particular people he's arming and the forces that he is reliant upon. He's no longer considered an authority of public order. You know, the People's Naval Division, it's a revolutionary hotbed. We need to move them, demobilize them, etc. So it's like, it's a deliberate disarming of this type of this thing that used to be a socialist demand, would have been considered a key socialist demand, arming of the people, and a victory for the standing army. So it's perhaps the, you know, they capitulate all down the line, but one of the most shameful is capitulating by returning to the good graces of the standing army and refusing the demand that the socialists have always had, which is to rely upon actual armed workers.
That also brings us closer, of course, to the role that the standing army has with respect to the state. It's in fact inconceivable without the state. And the state is exactly what social democrats are want to overthrow, because they see in Bismarck, right, an anti-democratic force.
I want to overthrow until ... which we'll get to pretty soon. I do want to say just one more, I don't know if this is the right place, but I feel like it foreshadows stuff we'll get into later. And if we're talking about things that Marxists and social democrats, their orientation toward the war that distinguishes them from others who, you know, see this looming threat coming, and particularly distinguishes them from other liberal, humanitarian, anti-war pacifists, and some on the right of social democracy, is that resumption of the status quo is also not a satisfactory outcome if war breaks out. Mm-hmm. That for many, especially for pacifists, just it's enough to say peace immediately, no taking of land from other nations, everything back, you know, the European status quo is back.
No indemnities.
Right. Whereas actually for social democrats, this is really interesting. There's some strong arguments that if war breaks out and what happens at the end is status quo, that's more of a setback for social democracy than if war had never broken out and things had just been gradually moving along. That was a chance to actually, be an aggressor, be a class aggressor against the state in such a chaotic time.
I mean, if you're ever provoked into aggression, you would think now would be the time. This is kind of like your numbers being called historically, so to speak. You know,
I think that's exactly what today's episode's about. The episode is about when the number got called.
Right.
In the most obvious way in history so far, I think that's true. I think it's the most genuinely revolutionary moment in European history thus far. And it's a whiff.
Before we get to the great disgrace, I want to make sure that everyone got in any remarks they wanted to edgewise about the sort of relationship just between Marxist theory and this particular war. I think Matt already referenced the Trotsky pamphlet, War and the International, and in that he makes the case, or claims that, you know, the Marxist case is vindicated by the appearance of the war. And I just am curious if we agree and if we think there is a unique Marxist explanation for it in general.
Well, in the most basic terms, the Marxist case is vindicated just because it's made clear that these people can't keep managing world affairs. even just at that level, the bourgeoisie can't be in charge. There's plenty more, but we can start there as a really easy pitch.
Right. I mean, if only because it doesn't look like they're going to manage super imperialism.
No, it doesn't look like that's in the cards.
There really, I mean, you know, in the Napoleonic period, there was a long period when major powers, no matter how distinct they were in their domestic politics, in their, even their confessional, identifications, that is religious identification, they came together to oppose the French Revolution and created a kind of, you know, the Holy Alliance is a kind of, you know, is at least an international of sorts. There was no such bourgeois international to counter the social democratic international in this period, which leads us to war in the first place. So I don't think that the war was inevitable for a number of reasons. But one of the reasons was that the bourgeoisie itself, I think, had it taken a different path, would have been able to avoid going to war.
Well, but what Marxism is right about is what the war is about right now. And absolutely refusing to acknowledge any version or explanation of the war as being a war of national defense, being a war that's meant to secure the freedom for the progression of democracy, that this war has no, the working class has no interest in it. It is just, again, one of the more monstrous manifestations of capitalism. We're seeing new gruesomeness that it's capable of. But to me, the war doesn't need to be seen. I mean, it's a pivot historically, obviously. It's a deep turning point for a number of reasons we'll get to. But to me, you know, the Marxist explanation for it is better because the Marxist explanation for society, for the social world, is better. And that's why the real deep capitulation to me is this refusal, this denial of the class struggle by constituent parties during this period, because the war is nothing if not the class struggle reaching its highest possible pitch, the pitch of genuine civil war in international war. And that's the exact moment when we decide that class is no longer the dominant factor, that we're willing to collaborate with bourgeois parties. At the exact moment.
For the sake of defending our state against neighboring states. It clearly is the case that proletarians identified with their state more than they identified with their class. Obviously state ideologies come in a number of guises. They can be a kind of, you know, in the pre-modern world, it's largely religious. In the modern industrialized world, it could be some version of patriotism, a national legend. In the case of Germany in this period, it's, you know, a military ideology itself, that stands in for state support. So it's clear that, that choice, is on the table. But I also want to say this about the war and vindication. When does the war happen is a good question. It's not clear when the Black Hand blows up a diplomat, a noble diplomat in Serbia, that we're about to go into an extended conflict. In fact, the war is only genuinely the war in retrospect. So, you know, Marxists had all kinds of theories, but I think it caught many people by surprise, the length, the level of destruction. The war is completely unprecedented. So on the one hand, sure, it was predicted, and we can read off some quotes, and I think we will. The Junius pamphlet by Rosa Luxemburg is filled with these quotations in which social democrats anticipate a cataclysmic war. But the war was also unimaginable at the scale in which it arrived. So we have to give some people a little bit of rope.
But okay, it's time to, now we have to face the music here for a moment and get down to brass tacks, as it were. When the war is declared, our precious Socialist International, the crown jewel of the international workingmen's movement, the imposing specter that is haunting all of Europe, does not put on an impressive display of resistance, to say the least. In fact, it ceases functionally to exist. We can talk about the really pathetic attempts to... we can talk about the attempts within the international apparatus itself to maintain some faux semblance of an internationalist current during the war. But I think that's, you know, we talk about the SPD because we've talked about it a lot on the podcast, but also this is, you know, as Rosa says in the pamphlet, this is the prototype of the Revolutionary Party. I mean, this is where everyone is looking. As the SPD goes, so goes the international. And the SPD, I don't know if we need to get into like super particulars. I feel like the story is actually quite well known, but famously votes for war credits.
That's right. So social democrats were elected to positions in the government end up voting in favor of the selling of bonds on the part of the German state to fund the war.
And, you know, in doing so delivers an infamous speech about how the social democrats will not abandon the fatherland in the time of need and necessity. And there's a genuine enthusiasm to some extent on the part of the leadership of this party, because the ruling class for once introduces what is called the Burgfrieden, which I'm sure I'm butchering that pronunciation to some extent, but it means actually peace inside the castle is what it means. And it's meant to say, okay, look, you know, the disloyal opposition that has been social democracy, that has gone through periods of genuine illegality and has always stood on the ground of not one man, not one penny for the ruling state, which has, you know, yada, yada, yada. I won't give the soapbox speech here. And they essentially allow themselves to be incorporated into an alliance with bourgeois parties. They openly lay down arms. They refuse to criticize the government.
Shut down strikes.
They shut down strikes. Of course, a classic, you know, people familiar with no strike pledges can see that here, you know.
Yeah.
And it really is. And in fact, you really do see a lot of them actually. And this is the great shame, right? It's a period of both war enthusiasm, but for a lot of the SPD leaders at this time, you get the sense that they exhale and they relax, and that they don't want to be in permanent opposition, that they've found it frustrating. And you see, in fact, a genuine enthusiasm towards being allowed into the closed-door meetings mm-hmm. with the chancellor. And being their praises are being sung in the bourgeois press, and they start to feel like maybe they are a part of the fabric of social life in Germany, and they need not, you know, castigate, you know, the ruling class so much. It's a genuine
this plays
collapse.
Out. They're right about that. In fact, Bernstein is invited to be the equivalent of a treasury secretary. They are in fact invited into government, and they had been before. We've talked about ministerialism on this podcast before. And I mean, it is the ministerialist avenue that so many of those parliamentary social democrats are aiming for. We should, I think, just for clarity's sake, just take a step back and be explicit about what a revolutionary in the Luxembourgian camp would have thought correct behavior on the part of elected social democrats in office to be. Let's just say explicitly what we thought that should have been. What should they have done?
Well, I mean, I think part of the answer to that is that it would have had to be a bit. You would have had to concede that all you could do at the beginning was a fairly weak opposition, that there wasn't much of a mass mobilization that a party could do at that time, but that opposition would have meant everything in the world as war sentiment changed among the masses. And so I think that rather than calling a class truce, rather than, I forget who said this, some contemporary writer at the time, but that instead of letting it's the bullets from German guns that hit Russian workers bore the moral and political stamp of German social democracy, instead of doing that, if there's some opposition at the beginning, and even if you end up losing the fealty or the admiration or the moral authority among the masses, that's okay because you're sticking to principles that will become clear to the masses. I think Trotsky put it really well that the war did create a fervor, and it created a fervor among people who were never touched or reached by the social democracy, but also among workers who had been. It creates a fervor. You realize that there's a sense that the conditions that you hate and that mire you down might change. And it's a horrible way that they might, but it might be through war. But it returns them to, Trotsky put it, a pre-political condition. Mm-hmm. And when you capitulate as a political party with supposed political authority and leadership to a perceived, whether or not it's even real, a perceived pre-political fear and fervor among the people, then you've lost it. So you should have not done that.
you've entirely failed. And the person of Karl Liebknecht is worth discussing here, not just for his contributions, militarism and anti-militarism, but because, and I think we can talk about this as a general political phenomenon. He becomes an icon. And he becomes an icon.
But he's an elected official himself.
He's an elected official himself, but only late in his career. But what he becomes known for, and he spends the bulk, he's arrested in 1916, so a few years into the war, but isn't freed until the revolution. And even then, the upper echelons of the SPD are skeptical about releasing him. In fact, it's Scheidemann who says, you know, if we don't let him out, the millions of people will think these amnesties are fake, essentially.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point being, Liebknecht becomes a genuine popular icon, the so-called, to their chagrin, the SPD continuously calls him the most popular man in the trenches. And this gets to Matt's point, like, listen, wars are not popular.
That's right.
I know that to some extent we talk about the war fever and they're momentarily in a sense of genuine mass delirium. Or hopeless desperation, like you were just alluding to, that perhaps something will happen that will make life alter. Wars are not terribly popular. They're especially not popular amongst people who are sent to die in them. And in fact, that's why the SPD and the ruling class has to try so hard, has to work overtime to convince you that there's a reason you're doing it, because it's transparent that you're not. And Karl Liebknecht's ability to become the most popular left-wing politician, the most popular left-wing icon in Germany, not on the basis of his political work per se, not based on his organizational acumen, certainly not based on his high standing within the party, but based exclusively on being the one to say that this has to stop, I think is worth, you know, anytime the enormity of Karl Liebknecht's figure in history shows the revolutionary potential of an anti-war stance.
He anticipates the position of Lenin. Lenin's position on revolutionary defeatism, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, but no, I think it's relevant that his position on revolutionary defeatism is not immediately popular. It's not even immediately popular among his fellow Bolsheviks, even those closest to him. The idea that you should favor the massive military defeat of your own state sounds a lot like you're putting people in immediate danger and refusing to defend them against a foreign aggressor.
Defeatism gets a bad rep for the line, turn the imperialist war into a civil war. But I'm sorry, when the working class is being drafted by the ruling class to kill other working class comrades, that is a civil war. It's only some bizarre semantic or ideological mystification that allows us not to think that World War I is already a class civil war in each instance in which it's being conducted. So we're not actually trying to transform it. We're just trying to be like, to acknowledge what is in front of you, which is a civil war that you're participating in the destruction of your own class, which is what the constituent parties of the Second International fall into.
So is it the conclusion that social democracy fails to adequately respond to the conditions of world war because it doesn't turn out to be genuinely revolutionary, because their aims are still gradualist, because they're still ministerialists in their heart of hearts?
I mean, maybe partially that, but I also think that a large part of it, and something that we have to contend with and that history has tried to contend with, is that this was a mass party for whom unity was an enormously important principle. And since then, what we've instead dealt with is, you know, that there's obviously like purifying splits that we think are perfectly justifiable, but then it also becomes splits that are more and more ostensibly for the sake of purity, but it just renders these things small. So we do want to reclaim, what we want to reclaim from the Second International is some of the sense of that importance of unity. But when the unity is all about just mass growth, and when the unity lets itself become on the terms of the right, when you're in unity with the right of your movement purely on their terms, that's also how this happens. I think that the desire to keep growing, to not lose any of the workers who might have some reactionary bogeyman in their heads during the start of the war, I think that's a large part of it too. It's not just that they were necessarily a reformist party in what they did. It was also the kind of unity that they prized, and the distinctions among, you know, the way that we can understand different types of unity or unity on different terms, that's actually clear to us largely because of this. It would have been less intelligible to them at that time.
I agree with that. Actually, reading Edward Bernstein's reaction to the war is instructive in exactly these terms. He's concerned in the first instance about the split between the parties, the advent of an independent social democratic party, the USPD, which he joins because he does, in fact, oppose the war, but works, meticulously after that, he works diligently after that to try to draw these parties together, and rejoins the SPD, eventually abandons his independent social democratic party membership when the SPD makes that impossible to, or when one of the parties makes it impossible for him to have both affiliations. He's interested in precisely this kind of unity. The thing that also strikes me about his reaction is that he thinks that what the war is making harder is the transition of Germany, of a united German state, to parliamentary democracy with a genuine franchise, which he sees as the road to socialism. And I come back to opposition to the state being the genius of the Bolsheviks. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily, whatever it is. It's not necessarily a romantic sensibility with respect to councils that brings me to this position, or at least I hope not. It's the impossibility of aligning with a bourgeois state in the effort to construct a socialist economy.
Something that you asked about a second ago, is it because they're still ministerialists in their hearts? Gives us a, it's an adequate opportunity. So what explains this capitulation? And it's where we can talk about, you know, terms like opportunism, terms like reformism, whether these are just epithets thrown against our political enemies or what's the core there. And to me, like, the best I can explain the capitulation of the leadership of the SPD, like, I don't really have a lot of stake in, like, the labor aristocracy thesis, which blames, to some extent, layers of the class as such. I don't think that carries out. I also think enthusiasm for the war among the working class is consistently overrated. And in fact, that it was very thin. There's obviously the bureaucratism argument, which is about, you know, the sort of insularity of the leadership of the SPD, its increasing gap between the rank and file. I think that's true. But I really think, like, at the end of the day, like, we're not against reformism because we, out of some, like, petty love for, like, the concept of revolution, we're against reformism because what it can do is lead towards a demobilization, towards readiness, towards, you know, towards a preparedness for situations in which the party is called upon to actually summon and lead the class. The organization is meant to make the class fit to rule. And I think what we see is in, you know, and we can, I'm not going to relitigate, you know, episode 3 or 4 or whatever, where we talk about whether or not the gradualist, evolutionist passivity is to be blamed on a particular version of social development of historical materialism, which sees, you know, listen, socialism will rise inexorably. So we really don't have to do that much. And what I see this does is it constantly... It sort of, and you see this in debates on the mass strike, debates on sorts of things like this. Like, they're because they believe socialism to be inexorable, the progression towards socialism to be inexorable, they start to sand off the edges of the struggle part of class struggle. Until at the very end, there's very little there for the class to actually assert. And the problem for that, for reformism, is I would be for reformism if I thought it was viable. But what you see in the war period, from 1914 to 1919, in the war period and the revolutionary period, it's just the window for reformism, or whatever we want to call the window, like, reformism, the path of reformism is no longer viable. And you have to know what to do and confront it with the fact that reformism is no longer viable. And in what they do is deny that that is the case. They just live in denial. That the class struggle actually is reaching this extremely unstable, extremely volatile, extremely violent pitch. And that, to me, is what makes it sad. That the revolution... Look, the revolution doesn't just fail. The revolution is drowned in blood. Right. And I think that that is something that, like, you know, has to be emphasized to some extent as something... like a new arrangement, a society that's saturated in a violence that they're not prepared for.
I want to say something about inexorability, because I wonder, because, I mean, I'm, of course, very sympathetic to the idea that socialism is inevitable and an inexorable tendency within modern developed industrial economies. So I wonder whether or not the mistake, because I agree with you about the political conclusion, right? So I wonder if the mistake for me is the rank anachronism of Bernstein's view, to take one paradigmatic example, of Bernstein's view that what needs to happen at this advanced stage of capitalism is the French Revolution. You know, that's a weird denial of a stagist, progressivist, historical materialist theory of history.
Fighting the last war, as it were.
Yeah, you're fighting the last political war. But we're talking about an economy in which, you know, all of industry is going the way of the post office, the transportation sector, of the, you know, advanced, you know, electricity networks. We're talking about an increasingly socialized economy. And it just seems madness to me to assume that the proper political superstructure to fit to that economic base is a late 18th century French model.
Yeah, that's where you can get the, what's the line in State and Rev? Or maybe it's not in State and Rev, but where parliamentary democracy is historically irrelevant.
It's historically irrelevant.
Nathan brought up the labor aristocracy. And I think that's an important thing to touch on a little more, just because I think a lot of the a lot of what people attempt to do to make sense of this very difficult to contend with or accept series of events is that they try to find a scientific or Marxist or consistent theory of explaining behavior. And I think that's kind of like what labor aristocracy becomes. A lot of the conversations about opportunism even become that. And that can't be sufficient. And a lot of these, this is kind of the origin of a lot of, I think, the more tenuous categories that are still assigned to Marxism. It kind of comes out here. I think in addition to the things you guys have said, which I think are right, I was also a little convinced by Trotsky's point, which is that, you know, there was always kind of a disjuncture between the revolutionary resolutions and the Revolutionary Party press, for example, and the actual day-to-day life of the party, which was reformist. And that's not a condemnation of them. It was, in fact, in many ways, the only response to being in a monarchist police state was to be very gradual and to know that hopefully, gradually, you could catch up to actualizing that which you had theorized. But when what you're prepared for and what you've been doing is things like winning elections, tariff treaties, legislation, things like that, it's hard for the proletariat to be prepared to expend the same energy in fighting their own state when what you've been doing is winning concessions gradually.
And that's so right. Demonstrating the viability of the state to improve the lives of workers, which is a disaster.
And
this is where the concept of, I think we've said on the podcast, the negative integration concept, which is like actually when you stop being the disloyal opposition and you become the loyal integrated opposition, it's a very difficult path to walk without becoming, essentially a functioning element of that own state's legitimacy. Yeah.
And one more kind of paradoxical point that Stefan touched on earlier that I think is interesting is that I also think there were two kind of contradictory mistakes being made at the same time. One, when you brought up that, that Marx and Engels had talked about Russian czarism in a particular way as this imminent threat. And there was a bit of an anachronism when the Social Democratic Party press started talking about it the same way as a way to justify the war, when conditions had changed dramatically pertaining to Russian czarism since Marx and Engels' time. So it was kind of a not looking at the particulars and instead, you know, kind of trying to transplant theoretical or historical conclusions from the past. The flip side of that, though, is that they did have principles that had been developed and that had been fleshed out, and those crumbled in the face of particulars that I think they were misapprehending. And it's kind of hard to hold those two things together because they seem like opposites, but it does seem that they were happening simultaneously and reinforcing one another.
I want to read this particular Rosa quote from the Junius pamphlet. I was rereading the Junius pamphlet, and I was like, this is one that I think I'm just going to read it off, and then we can respond to it. I think it lends itself to putting a pin in the conversation, perhaps. This is from the pamphlet, which is actually called The Crisis in German Social Democracy. Rosa also is kind of famously told, but Rosa and Zetkin both contemplate suicide to each other in their correspondence when the SPD votes for war credits, to get the idea of like the enormity of like the deep, and Lenin of course famously doesn't believe it. He reads about it in the paper and thinks it's enemy propaganda. So this is like, this is the level of unthinkable capitulation that people have devoted their lives to this struggle. This is how they respond. But anyway, this is a line I wanted to read. One thing is certain. It is a foolish delusion to believe that we need only live through the war, as a rabbit hides under the bush to await the end of a thunderstorm, to trot merrily off in his old accustomed gait when all is over. The world war has changed the condition of our struggle, and has changed us most of all. Not that the laws of capitalist development, or the life and death conflict between capital and labor, have been changed or minimized. Even now, in the midst of war, the masks are falling and the old well-known faces grinning at us. But evolution has received a mighty forward impetus through the outbreak of the imperialist volcano. The enormity of the tasks that tower before the socialist proletariat in the immediate future make the past struggles of the labor movement seem but a delightful ideal in comparison. And I'm curious what we think.
Okay, so I think that the biggest mistake we can make is to think that the World War was a major event in the history of Marxism. I don't genuinely think that it was. And for the point that Rosa just makes, right, which is it doesn't change the laws of capitalist development. It doesn't necessarily, it changes the conditions of struggle in one major way, which is that the success of the Bolsheviks in Russia is the most important cause of organizational splits throughout Central Europe. And whatever we think about that, that changes the institutional conditions of struggle. But perhaps negatively, because the one thing that that social democracy loses as when it becomes communism, which is really getting ahead of ourselves in these episodes. But once communism is invented and then counterposed to social democracy, the ideal of unity of the working class movement, political unity, is destroyed. So maybe they are changed, but for the worse.
I mean, I think they're definitely changed for the worse, to be clear. Yeah. No, and I agree. I mean, the first thing that I was also going to isolate and agree with there is that, you know, she says explicitly the laws of capitalist development have not changed. And, you know, that's our through line from our orientation to imperialism, that we agree that, you know, Marx has been too hasty to identify these various historical developments as new phases in which abide by different laws. And now we need to go back to the drawing board with these theoretical modifications, etc. In the war, I don't think requires any substantial new theory. And the ones that kind of do emerge are sort of more functional problems, like when we talk about, like, you know, organized capitalism, state planning. You know, we see the war economies lead sort of naturally to a lot of conversations about what state planning and an organized economy would look like. Tricky problems, but whatever. But I mean, I think the change conditions of the struggle are important. They don't require rewrites of, like, our value theory or what have you. But in relation to the revolution, what we'll call the actuality of the revolution, like, this is important for the historical development of the workers' movement, which is not something that's simply, an adjacent concern of Marxism. It's a very central concern. And I know I kind of said this before, but I think it's worth remarking on this, the period is inaugurated. The war begins and ends and is punctuated more than before by a series of political assassinations. Karl Liebknecht, like days before he dies, writes that he will remain in opposition because he is not fearful of going back to prison, of being put in chains. He's been there before. And what he doesn't realize, and what none of them, I think, realize, is that actually they're going to kill you this time. Do so gleefully, essentially. And you can read histories of this period and read the bourgeois press upon the death of Liebknecht. They're positively, you know, salivating, you know, rejoicing, essentially. It also has that in common with the counter-revolution of the French Revolution. And what we see, like, the change conditions of struggle, and I'm willing to grant that this is not a permanent change, but, like, this, we're entering a period in which, like, the movement becomes so saturated with violence that, of course, the unity of the working class movement is broken irretrievably by the counter-revolution in Germany. I was reading Emil van der Velde.
Van der Velde,
the Second International's your favorite reformist.
He's Flemish, or is he Dutch? He's Flemish.
He's Belgian.
Okay.
So. Because he loves the Allies in the war because of Belgium. And he goes to Russia after the revolution. He's hanging out with all after the first revolution when the war has not been ended. And this is the thing that, like, made me realize that, like, all my dreams of unity, because I'm a unity guy. I've said on the podcast that I kind of have this Plekhanov thing where I, like, you know, I'd rather shoot myself in the head than see the party split. Plekhanov, by the way, who then later during the war says he would gladly bayonet German comrades. just whatever. Telling this story too long. Van der Velde is in Russia, and he's talking about the Bolshevik propaganda that he despises. And the thing that he hates is that it encourages fraternization with the enemy. And he thinks that this is the most despicable thing to tell the soldiers to do, to talk to their fellow workers across the line from the trenches. And I'm like, I'm sorry. At this point, the wisp of unity is even more worthless than the wisp of reformism. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's just... It's deeply despairing.
I think in that Rosa quote, just like you two, I appreciate the notion that the fundamental laws of capitalism haven't changed, because I do think it's worth reasserting as many times as we can that there's a different It's between stages or phases and features that are more or less pronounced at certain times. And I think we see a lot of the things that are described over hastily, I agree with Nathan, as phases or stages are in fact features whose prominence ebbs and flows. So that's good. I also think the way that she describes the enormity, the way that Trotsky does, the way that all these people are describing the enormity of what just happened is also kind of doubly tragic, because they are face to face with this enormous failure, but they're kind of seeing the tip of the iceberg of despair that is to come. And it is the end of this era of classical Marxism, of this era of social democracy. And it is hard to know what to do with the fact that this is exactly what all of this should have been preparing for. And this was the failure of internationalism, and internationalism is such a defining feature of the era. And then the violence and the betrayals and things that are to follow. So I do think, yeah, it doesn't change our theory, but it gives rise to a whole new set of strategic and tactical questions and questions about party building. And it gives rise to a lot of questions that are still unresolved. And unfortunately, also in my mind, to a lot of new categories and debates that kind of are inane and grating and still going on.
You know, I'm put in mind of what lessons were learned. And I'm also put in mind of the fact that, as you say, social democracy should have geared up for this. Mm-hmm. And boy, should it have, given what Kautsky said about the inevitability of war, the coming war.
And this is Kautsky in 1907, actually arguing against Babel, which I think is very interesting, at a Congress. Babel, who's trying to insist at this point on the distinction and on the necessity of having criteria for a war of aggression versus a war of defense. And so Kautsky says, "As a matter of fact, what we are concerned with in case of war is not a national, but an international question. For a war between great powers will become a world war and will affect the whole of Europe, not just two countries alone. Someday the German government might make the German proletariat believe they were being attacked. The French government might do the same with its subjects. And then we should have a war in which the French and German working men would follow their respective governments with equal enthusiasm and murder each other and cut each other's throats. Such a contingency must be avoided, and it will be avoided if we do not adopt the criterion of the aggressive or defensive war, but that of the interests of the proletariat, which at the same time are international interests. Fortunately, it is a misconception to assume that the German social democracy, in case of war, would want to judge by national and not by international considerations, that it would feel itself to be first a German and then a proletarian party."
Babel, though, did get one thing right, which is he died in 1913. So that was to his credit.
It does give us a positive development, a silver lining, which is that it drives home a point that Karl Liebknecht makes, which is that, and he draws this observation from his class enemies, that social democracy, the question of social democracy, is in the last instance a military question.